My name is Sarah Osgood. I am the Director of Policy Implementation at the Department of Public Service. And in my capacity here, I'm serving as a designee for the Chair of the Public Service Commission in chairing this panel. So thank you all for joining today. Thank you, panelists, and thank you, attendees. I see that we have a number of our panelists in attendance here, including Corinne, Bill, Anel, Kit, Emily, Cheyenne, John Reese, Stephen, Darren, and Lori. And I might have missed a couple that have just joined recently. I got Betta here as well. So it looks like we've got a good number of folks, so let's get moving. Next slide, please. So it's as in our previous two meetings, we've had, we're going to follow a similar format in this meeting. The agenda will jump right into the recommendations discussion shortly. Then we'll have a short next step conversation. We'll break for about 5 minutes, hopefully, and then we'll begin our public input session, targeting to start that at 3:30. And so similar to the previous two meetings as well, we're the objective here, we want to discuss a subset of the recommendations. And then with each of those recommendations that we discuss, try to work through next steps necessary to bring the recommendations, the draft recommendations, back to the panel for a vote at a subsequent meeting in April. For folks that are listening as attendees, we don't yet have the meeting scheduled for April, but we will do that soon and get that posted to the Climate Act website. And then obviously the public input session is to gather public input on the draft recommendations discussed here today, as well as any others that folks feel a desire to comment on. And we are going to be recording the public session of the meeting here today so we can accurately capture the public comments. Next slide, please. So as we'll be taking public input, just a couple housekeeping items here. We will take the verbal comment at the end of the meeting, the last hour, which is we're planning to have from 3:30 to 4:30. If you'd like to put in, if you'd like to have a verbal comment, we ask that you just sign up by clicking on the Q&A button as shown in the picture here and entering your name. You can also feel free to use the chat feature to provide comments throughout the meeting. We may not be able to respond to all of those comments, but please be assured that they will be saved and reviewed with the whole panel, so that they will be considered. And then we also have other mechanisms to take public comments. We can you can email them to powergenpanel@dps.ny.gov. We also have a toll-free hotline where you can call and leave a verbal message. And that number is 833-498-2082. And so with those logistics out of the way, let's jump forward into the content that we're going to discuss today. Next slide, please. And next slide. So as you can see from this slide here, the items that we are planning to talk about today include reliability for the future grid, distributed generation and distributed energy resources, methane leakage, and then a few additional topics that don't quite rise to their own recommendation at this point in time, but a couple topics that we did want to touch on under the category of reaching zero emissions by 2040. Next slide, please. So, as folks may be familiar, we have recommendation slides that kind of come in a package of three here. And so three slides for each initiative. And so what I'm going to do is go over the next three slides describing the initiative, and then I'll open it up to panel members to expand on anything that I've shared or to ask questions or engage in discussion. Again, I'll just remind folks that these are draft recommendations being put forward from the subgroups of the panel, and so maybe that not all panel members have had a chance to fully digest or engage in the complete discussion, and so some of that is what we're trying to accomplish here. And so starting out with reliability here, obviously reliability is of significant concern to the, or considerable interest to the panel, particularly given some of the recent events that we've seen in Texas with the results, the impact of their grid to extreme weather events. And so as we're looking towards New York's grid, we want to make sure that the generation resources, the transmission, the distribution, control centers, and the wholesale markets really work together continuously to have a reliable system. And because the system is made up of multiple components, we really need to transition all of these elements together. And if we do it in a smart way, then we can help to, in a smart way in terms of planning and where some of the resources are placed and how we control them, then we'll be able to build a more flexible and resilient grid, which will help protect us against the impacts of climate change as well as mitigate the impact of climate change. And so kind of moving down the slide here, the costs for this we see as relatively minimal in terms of the whole process for maintaining reliability. The state has a well-known process, and so really it's more about executing in terms of the challenges here. And so, you know, some of the risks that we see are essentially time is not on our side, and we need to be diligent to ensure that that we keep an eye on reliability, and if issues do arise, that we can address them swiftly. Basically, we want to keep both the CLCPA mandates as well as the reliability rules working in concert together. And so we're seeing that as a lot of advanced planning. We also have transmission constraints that exist today that can limit the flexibility of the grid. And so we want to make sure that we're not exacerbating that challenge and actually working to relieve it. So in terms of the how we plan to mitigate some of those risks, effective communication processes across all the organizations that are involved is important. I guess so important that we put it on the slide here twice. Whoops. Regardless, still important. We want to enhance the market rules to make sure that all the resources can contribute to the market based on their attributes. And we want to increase transmission, particularly in zones G through J, which can also help to address the peaker issues. Next slide, please. In terms of the components of the strategy, the draft recommendation is to establish biennial checkpoints that would be used to assess the state of the bulk power system and determine whether any adjustments are needed for continued safe and adequate service. Next one, we should do power system studies and planning to integrate analyses to consider climate change impacts as well as the need for reliability and resiliency. I think the resiliency here piece is quite important. While reliability is kind of built to the everyday, what do we expect? The situation in Texas where they saw the extreme cold that they were not used to and the impact of that really shows it's also important to be resilient to those operating conditions. And believe that the actions that will be required to ensure reliability should also be reflected in the state energy plan. So we need to also kind of continue the physical works in terms of protecting our grid for reliability. That's protecting against storm hardening, potentially elevating equipment, moving lines, and as the system changes, we'll need to look at the design criteria as well, and perhaps change that to reflect the changing situation and impacts of climate change. And then the market products, requirements, technology standards that all go into ensuring reliability also should be updated through time to make sure that we're not imposing any undue costs, as well as ensuring that we're on track to meet the CLCPA goals. Next slide. In terms of the benefits and impacts of this, we really do see for disadvantaged communities, affordability is a real concern. It's a double-sided coin, as some of our members here see it. While the cost of building a reliable system and building a resilient system, obviously that costs money. At the same time, power outages do tend to have a disproportionate impact on disadvantaged communities. And so going into this, those are kind of the some of the key concerns as we look at this. And so looking now and into the future, we believe that disadvantaged communities should be prioritized in terms of restoration of service. Obviously, any exposure to extreme hot or cold weather events can lead to the impact the grid can also lead to loss of life, loss of property. And so that's really important, and we see it as a key driver here. And as we transition, we also need the reliability is also important to businesses and industries that rely on strong power quality and a reliable grid. And so all of these things essentially are driving us back toward the same issue of we need good planning, we need collaboration, and while also keeping a mind on the cost of this work. And so with that, those are the three slides on reliability. Perhaps it makes sense to go back to the back one slide to the components slide before opening it up to other panel members. I'm not sure if I can see hands. I don't see any hands right now. Oh, I see John Reese.
Besides simply checking that worked, I On the very first slide in this section, we identified, if you could go back one slide, it would help me. We identified ease of implementation as being easy. And so I think we spent a lot of time on the components of these slides. I think it's in a good place. We all recognize this is an iterative process that we have to continue to evaluate and project what our future needs are. And I think the processes are largely in place, and that part is easy. The actual accomplishing the infrastructure goals necessary is by no means easy, and I just wanted to clarify that doesn't refer to solving the problem. That is, in the easy is in analyzing the problem, and that we already have systems. We need to continue to improve them, but they're in place.
Thank you, John. That's a real good point. I appreciate that. Emily, I see your hand up.
Good afternoon. I wanted to make a couple of comments. First of all, Sarah expressed my appreciation for you stepping into the role and leading this panel. That's really allowed for a seamless transition, and that's very much appreciated. I'd also like to thank my fellow panel members for their work on this recommendation, including an explicit recommendation on reliability, recognizes that reliability is a critical part of the grid transformation that we are all working toward, but also one that cannot be taken for granted. We need to sustain what is working well, and we need to improve on what can be improved upon. Continuing with the comment that John made, I do agree with the characterization that continuing the history of strong communication that we have in New York on reliability issues is critical. And given the scope and scale of some of our other recommendations, is appropriately characterized as implemented with ease. But certainly the value of continuing the practice in New York of communicating with one another, engaging in tough conversations on reliability and a number of other issues before us is absolutely critical. So I think that including this recommendation sets us down a good path to resolving, the challenges that inevitably will be before us in this transformation. So thank you.
Thank you. And I'm not sure the order here, but I see Kip's hand and then Bill.
Thank you, Sarah, and my thanks also to you for taking on sharing this group. And I'd like to echo Emily's comments and thank you, Emily, for your leadership and the expertise that you've provided on this set of recommendations. Reliability is absolutely crucial to New York, for all New Yorkers, for reasons ranging from public health to economic factors. And just wanted to highlight the interconnectedness of many of these ideas. And I think the slide does a good job showing that. While there are challenges associated with scaling up renewables to high levels on the grid, integrating those renewables will also bring benefits in terms of building a more flexible and resilient grid to address the impacts of climate change as well as mitigating climate change. So climate change is making grid reliability harder through creating extreme weather events similar to what we saw in Texas, the extreme heat conditions that other areas have seen. So operating the grid safely becomes harder as the impacts of climate change become more severe. And adding renewables and flexible clean energy, distributed energy resources to the grid can help mitigate climate change and help address those impacts on the grid. So again, I think this set of recommendations is really coming along nicely. And again, that reliability is absolutely crucial to the success of the CLCPA.
think you can. Bill?
Thank you. And could we advance one slide to the direct recommendations? And while we're doing that, I will further the comments of my colleagues that this is absolutely vital. And I think the group has done a very nice job of bringing forward some very good recommendations on the reliability area. And I just want to make one clarifying point on one of the recommendations here, because I am supportive of all of these recommendations. And I would further John Reese's point that it's not going to be easy to do all of what we have to do to do the reliability here. The one point I'd like to bring forward on the recommendations themselves, it involves the very last one here, which is, says that the market products requirements and technology standards should be updated throughout time. And I think that's very, very important. What's not overtly here, and what I think was implied in our conversations, I know I viewed it that way in our conversations in the subgroups, was that that included actually looking at how we evaluate reliability. And the reason why I bring that up is that we today evaluate reliability primarily, at least for how much reserve margins we need, primarily by looking at what would happen if we lose a resource. So we do all these probabilistic analyses, and I know my colleagues mostly know this quite well. I just want to make sure I'm level setting for everyone. We mostly do calculations where we look at rolling the dice many, many thousands of times of you lose a power plant or you lose a line, what would happen? And when you get to very high renewables, the whole risk profile is different. It is much more important to understand if you lose all the wind at one time, if you have a sudden calm point, or you have sudden cloud cover, and also something else happens. And to Kit's point, you know, there's actually a lot of benefits that happen with those high renewables. But it's very important that in looking at the benefits and also looking at the risk profiles that we evolve how we're doing our studies. And I don't say this as a negative to what's happening today. I know the ISO is already looking at some of these things. But I do believe that this last this last suggestion should be broadened slightly to make absolutely sure that we're encompassing the idea of doing the evaluations somewhat differently to properly reflect what are the true risks in a very high renewable grid, as opposed to losing a power plant when power plants are a very small portion of the power production in the future, or traditional power plants, I should say. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. John, I see your hand is up. I'm not sure if that's a legacy hand. And then Emily?
Unfortunately, it doesn't want to go down unless you see it as down now.
I don't, sorry.
Yeah, it says it's down.
Okay.
Sorry, ignore me until I wave my hand.
That's okay. It could be on my end. Beta, I see your hand is up.
Yeah, hi everybody. Really great work pulling the recommendations together. So appreciate all of you who spent quite a bit of time on this. And just wondering, since I wasn't involved in those conversations, did like preparedness for power outages come up much? And I just wonder, I mean, even though obviously, like, you know, we're doing everything we can to ensure reliability, and that's so, so important. But I think people still are worried about reliability. And I just wonder, like, even from a utility, like how good of a job are utilities doing, like communicating with customers about what happens if there's a power outage? You know, do communities and towns and have, you know, a place where everyone can go where they know the power won't go out? I mean, just, you know, kind of very basic level of how good of a job are we doing educating New Yorkers about, you know, what happens if and when that does happen? So I was just curious whether like that type of planning came up or not. And I know that this is such a big topic and there's so much to cover with all of this. And maybe this wasn't the, you know, place for that concern, but was just wondering.
Respond to that. I raised my hand, but I don't know if that's coming across. So that's a great question. From my perspective, thinking about how to respond to extreme weather events and some of the steps that the utilities have been taking to respond to those types of situations comes through in the recommendation that's second from the bottom of this page. But I think that there's potentially an opportunity to expand what's being conveyed on that point, to go beyond sort of the physical infrastructure of the grid itself and the distribution system itself, but also to incorporate some of the processes that are designed in those events to allow for effective communication with the public. So that might be something that we should take back and consider further. I'd also like to amplify and echo Bill's point that certainly I think it's completely reasonable and should be expected that with the checkpoints that are contemplated through time, the biennial checkpoints, that it'll be absolutely necessary that the techniques and the studies with the evaluation of the emerging risks need to evolve through that time and inform what's necessary for reliability. So I think both of those points are really great and on point to integrate into this recommendation.
Thank you, Emily. I'm not seeing any other hands at this moment. I'll just give it a second in case there are any other panel members that would like to weigh in on this. All right, not seeing any. I'll move to the next initiative then. Slide 9, please. Oh, already there. Thank you. And so another complementary initiative that we're looking at is distributed generation and distributed energy resources. And the panel is looking at this as, if you're generating smaller amounts of clean electricity closer to the end users, you can increase the efficiency of that generation, reduce carbon pollution, improve grid resiliency, and potentially curtail the need for costly transmission investments. In terms of risks and barriers, a lot of this, comes down to an efficient process. How can we, if we're looking to scale this up, how do we take some of the cost, take some of the kind of the challenges in that are kind of common to all projects? How do we help to streamline them? And the other recognition the panel has is that in some cases there's local community opposition to projects. And so we need to make sure that the projects are, those local projects are benefiting those in the local community. In terms of possible mitigants, as we'll get into a little bit in some of the next slides, we've got an idea to focus on high benefit projects that would focus on the local communities, maybe have a little dual use between solar and agriculture activities, and to continue to invest in energy delivery, both energy storage as well as transmission and distribution upgrades. Next slide, please. In terms of the components of delivery, some of the key elements come down to hosting capacity, looking at accelerating adoption of technologies and programs that can increase hosting capacity. We also want to be proactive and timely in those investments and provide appropriate resources for application processing. And in that, I think, you know, resources can be money in some cases, but I think here we also mean in terms of personnel at the utilities in processing interconnection applications. Moving on to rate design, we see the need to send appropriate price signals to customers that will incentivize the clean distributed energy resources deployment and use that's in areas that are helpful to the grid, as opposed to just kind of wherever they might seem good, but then they may not provide as many benefits, or even worse, potentially not add to the flexibility of the grid. And there's still work to be done on ground-mounted siting as well. There's been some resistance that's recognized, and the panel is looking to address that. For rooftop permitting, need more streamlining, as I had mentioned before. And then on codes, looking at for new construction, can properties be designed as solar ready, or, you know, perhaps even further, requiring distributed generation? And so looking at kind of the intersection of those. Moving to the next slide, please. We see that for disadvantaged communities, we really see this initiative as potentially helping reliability and air quality in those communities. And if we're successful in this and can properly develop these programs, we can also expand the opportunity for disadvantaged communities and their residents to participate in the clean energy economy, including economic development and workforce opportunities. We also see this as a way to potentially help to close some fossil generating facilities, whereby we could increase air quality and decrease emissions. And in terms of businesses, industries, and workers, we see this as a really strong opportunity for additional opportunities in a wide range of fields here. And with that, I'm gonna maybe ask if some of the folks that were more directly involved in the drafting and kind of discussion of these recommendations, if they want to add anything. And I see that Shyam's hand is up. I think you were involved in this. Shyam?
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. And good afternoon, everybody. So, first of all, I think that overall the ER section is in good shape, and really appreciate the time that we were able to dedicate through subgroup discussions on this topic, and your colleagues spending time on allocating time for discussion here. So I have two areas of feedback here. The first one, I think, goes back to the very first slide on this initiative. And goes back to some of the the comments with regard to siting and community opposition. So I don't know where this will, I guess, and this is, I guess, on the recommendation side where, I guess, or mitigant side. So, you know, one thing that I think is needed, but may be underway to some extent is having regional state convened discussion forums between you know, local communities and I guess community solar or ground-mounted DER stakeholders to basically facilitate mutual dialogue and understanding of both groups' perspectives. I think, you know, that is something that it's a simple suggestion, simple step, but, you know, I think historically there hasn't been too much, you know, exchange of perspectives from between community representatives and, you know, who have concerns about ground-mounted solar and even, you know, non-solar projects. And to that point, you know, I do know that ICERDA is looking to create such a forum, specifically in the context of concerns about ag land and solar development. So that's one particular area of concern that, you know, communities have been providing. And so I've heard that there's a proposed group called the Agricultural Technical Working Group that is going to be convened, I believe, in April. But I still think it would be good to have that recommendation. The second one is, you know, with regard to local or community concern about solar specifically, you know, I think, you know, some of the concerns, you know, appropriation of agricultural land, visual impact, those are issues that do need discussion, and you know, I think the solar stakeholders or clean energy stakeholders need to be sensitive to. But then there are other other concerns where I think, you know, the facts and the science don't necessarily support the concern. So, for example, concerns about leakage or leaching, radioactivity, and also potentially, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but, you know, concerns about habitat destruction and soil erosion, you know, where it may not be, the science may not indicate that the concern or the potential impact is to the degree that the perception is. So I think one other recommendation there is just programmatic initiatives to increase to address some of these common conceptions around the environmental risks associated with solar and other DER systems and their siting, and the impacts they cause. So that would be one recommendation. And then if we turn to the next slide, after this one, the second comment I had was on section two of these recommendations. My vote would be to not bundle up rate design and incentives in the same subsection. I really don't think they directly interact. They should directly interact with each other. I think rate design really deserves its own discussion and a much more holistic discussion, as was raised by Laurie, I think, in the last subgroup meeting here. Because, you know, and particularly about, you know, having some guardrails or protections in place by for folks who would be burdened by substantial rate increases or any changes in rate structures. So my vote would be to actually have a separate section on, I guess, incentives and compensation, where I think we originally had a section on compensation for DER where, you know, there was a recommendation about looking at how the value stack tariff could be improved to more accurately reflect the value of DER generation. And then and that's where I think, you know, incentives could also be part of the same discussion, where if we can actually get compensation right, then incentives going forward really become relevant more for projects that provide a higher societal benefit than just providing clean energy, whether it's brownfield projects, landfill projects, or dual use projects, etc. So that would be those are the two points I would make here. Other than that, I think this looks in pretty good shape.
Thank you. Bill?
Yes, thank you. And let me start by thanking the group, and particularly Cheyenne, for really bringing forth a set of very good recommendations around these issues and organizing them in a way that I think indicates the key areas of importance. When I look at these recommendations, I agree with Shyam on the separation, the distinction he was making in the second section here on this slide. In the first section, I want to make sure we're clear also that 1A and 1B here are both hosting capacity. We really have two ways of increasing hosting capacity. One is by making investments to the actual local transmission and distribution infrastructure. And the other is to adjust how the devices interact and operate on the grid. And that's what 1B gets to, where, you know, for instance, if you have a solar project that is being put onto the grid and it has to be downsized because of voltage fluctuations, you can make that a solar and storage project combined and have the battery smooth out those voltage fluctuations and allow you to put a much bigger solar project on. Likewise, you can use smart inverters and coupled loads and other innovative technologies to dramatically increase how much DG you can put onto a particular circuit. So the 1A and 1B here are kind of two sides to the same issue of whether we're doing it by increasing the capability of the local transmission system to take the power, or if we're doing it by adjusting how the DG operates and is coupled with energy storage and other things to be able to optimize how much can be put on, and in many cases doing both also. So I just want to be clear that those go together. So supporting Cheyenne's point about separating out incentives from rate design and strengthening the point about putting together the 1A and 1B. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Stephen?
Thanks, Sarah. Yeah, so I want to first just acknowledge Cheyenne's role and putting this together. I think a lot of this does seem to be in order. The point I would make, and I want to reinforce and, you know, apologize for not having had the opportunity to manipulate the slides prior to this meeting, but just thinking on the social equity side and in terms of the recommendations we're making serving communities of color and low income, just want to note that, like, greasing the skids generally, like, it still presents the risk of continuing to leave disadvantaged communities behind in how the rollout of renewable distributed energy goes. And so I'm just really thinking and would like to sort of lodge, you know, make sure it was lodged as a recommendation, like making sure we clarify the state's role in connecting high barrier groups of folks with distributed energy resources in sort of in an affirmative way. I mean, there's obviously necessary, as you know, it says taking steps to do this, but for me, it's like step up these efforts, create some affirmative role for, you know, NYSERDA potentially to make sure that they're reaching folks who can stand to benefit. I think, like, between distributed renewable generation and energy efficiency, these are really the two primary ways in which we're going to meet the social equity strictures of the law. And so making sure that these folks aren't being left behind in this conversation is, like, really key. And I think insofar as the market doesn't serve these people, it really does fall to the state to create the sort of bulwark against further sort of marginalization. So just want to make sure that finds its way in there somewhere. It is sort of, I think, on the next slide, you talk about the impacts, but I think that it should really be reflected in the recommendations sort of proper. Thanks.
not Lisa on mute. It's me on mute. Whoops. Thank you. Sorry. Thank you, Stephen. Lisa, I was wondering, I was accusing you of potentially being on mute with me.
I was on mute until this moment. I just want to thank everyone for all of the great work that has gone into this. And I just wanted to uplift everything that's been said before me. I think they're all amazing points. And one, the only comment that I have here is I know that, you know, we've been working, you know, just to manage all of the workload. But to bring it back to the whole, and one of the things that I think is really important in capturing these recommendations and really linking them up with a recommendation on how, you know, like the future of gas planning. This idea that I think that one thing that we either might want to put here or that we want to put in the overall recommendations is this idea that's on the table right now with this comprehensive gas planning docket, where, you know, we're looking at all of the creative strategies that where we can partner with the utilities, the local transmission owners, and just distribution infrastructure, and, you know, the other technologies, you know, in addition to distributed energy, like demand response, efficiency solutions, and storage, and really kind of link some of these best ideas up with, in the context of phasing out gas and, you know, the existing gas and getting, you know, our overall electric sector emissions to zero by 2040, you know, how can these ideas be combined in creative RFP-like structures that are really targeted to get the gas, you know, to move gas out of the electric sector and really pair up these ideas in a comprehensive planning process through an incentive structure like the creative RFPs, very similar to like what the Long Island Power Authority did on the South Fork. And so I just wanted to bring that idea back into this discussion so that, you know, these ideas are also embedded in that overall gas phase out from now until 2040. Thanks.
Thanks, Lisa. Beta? You're on mute, Beta.
I think we'd have learned that by now, but still so easy to do. I like Lisa's point about you know, the creative RFPs, and it definitely you know, connects also to the issue about, you know, connecting to phasing out gas. And you know, I'm wondering if we could add as a recommendation to the high benefit projects, which I thought the ones that we have are great, you know, the co-locating with ag and also, you know, brownfields, and all of that is so important. But I was thinking, you know, additionally, affordable multifamily housing would be great, and especially downstate. And as we think about, you know, electrifying our building sector, affordability is a really big challenge. And so co-locating as much as possible solar and heat pumps, and target incentives that way, I think could be terrific. And even, you know, and this, I think we have in another recommendation, but the idea of identifying, you know, where we can do geothermal downstate, you know, because of the winter peak demand issue that we know is coming. And as much as possible, you know, just really prioritizing affordable housing and making it so
For you know, building owners can you know implement DER and pair it you know with electrification. So just some thoughts, and maybe that's getting too specific for this. I don't know, but I mean, of course, it would also be great to see more you know rooftop on like big box stores, which I think we didn't get to really you know. Talk about that in great detail at our subcommittee meeting, and I know that these recommendations address that somewhat, but it does just make me wonder, you know, why aren't we seeing solar on the roof of every Walmart, you know, and especially downstate, you know, where we have this real need. So and just looking as much as possible at that kind of disturbed land, even though you know we're going to need we need to do it all. So just wanted to put some ideas out there and just something I'm hoping we can talk more about.
Thank you, Beta. I do still see Cheyenne's hand as well as Stephen's. I'm not sure if those are legacy hands.
Yes, sir. Mine is legacy. I can't unraise it for some reason.
Okay.
Same. I just unraise it. You got to use a little.
All right, great. You
know, down below, as opposed to next to it, I think.
Okay. All right, any more reactions or points that the panel members would like to make regarding the DGDER? I'm not seeing any. Oh, Bill, I saw your hand go up.
Actually, I just wanted to pick up on Beta's mention of the question about why we're not seeing solar on all the big box store roofs. I do believe that's that there are some recommendations that can be made around that, and I'd recommend that the subgroup we take a look at that and potentially add that to these recommendations, because I think Ben is raising a really important point. That's an opportunity that we really should address.
Thanks, Bill. All right, and with that, I'm not seeing any more hands on this topic, so let's advance another couple slides to number 12 on methane leakage. So before we get too far into this discussion, I do just want to make note that there are discussions that are still ongoing in the subgroups regarding the gas infrastructure, and so while that's not fully included in within this methane leakage draft recommendation that's presented here today, that is something that is being discussed in the subgroups, and we do see it as likely that we'll be bringing a recommendation forward regarding that, but really focusing here on trying to focus here on methane leakage from the natural gas system. And so we all know that methane is a very potent greenhouse gas with significant impacts on global warming, particularly in the short term. And we know that the natural gas system is not just something that we can shut off one day to the next. And so we rely on gas today, and we likely will into the near future, the very near future. And so it's important to continue to focus on decarbonizing that system effectively and reliably. Some of the challenges we see, really the natural gas system is an extensive network. It's statewide, it's in buildings, it's underground, And so it can be difficult and challenging, expensive to get to some of these areas. And because it is such an extensive network, as we transition away from the gas system, we'll also have to balance the need for continued maintenance on the system to have it operate in a safe way, while also avoiding stranded assets. And so it's we want to invest enough that we kind of keep the system operational, but we don't want to invest so much that that we end up with these massive investments that we then can continue to pay for long after the system is used. Also, New York isn't the only player in this when it comes to regulating the network of natural gas infrastructure. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission also oversees interstate natural gas transmission. And so that just creates additional challenges in terms of planning and coordination. But again, kind of back to, we tend to be kind of beating some of the same drums here. Improved planning and coordination is one of the things that we're seeing as a possible mitigant to that. And even looking at inventorying the infrastructure to prioritize where we actually go after the leak detection and repair services. Again, coordination with both regional and federal entities, and related to the challenges in getting to some of this infrastructure, we also see advances in leak detection and repair technology as a possible opportunity to mitigate some of those risks. Next slide, please. For the components of the strategy, it's number one and number two are kind of supporting the continued path that DEC is on. So supporting their current efforts to promulgate regs to decrease methane emissions from natural gas infrastructure, and also to do so going forward, realizing that as we move forward, other efforts to control methane emissions could be the enhanced leak detection and repair technology, as I mentioned, looking at inventorying where we do have control and what we can prioritize in those areas, and also ensuring proper operation and maintenance of the system. We do think while putting forward the opportunities for leak detection and repair technologies to advance, we also want to encourage that. And so we're looking at continued research and development in that area. Coordinating efforts and maybe even working with others to put out general guidance of how to address potential leaks. And I think this last item, developing a program to accurately characterize the natural gas infrastructure, really, that's again looking at the inventory and seeing can we better organize what we have and in which order we should go after it. Next slide, please. In terms of benefits, obviously methane being a greenhouse gas is, reducing the emissions of that is a very good thing, but methane is also a precursor to ozone, which can impact disadvantaged communities disproportionately. So we see this as a direct benefit that we can provide to disadvantaged communities in the prioritization. there are different areas where we can focus on leak detection and repair services, and you can see by the numbers here, there's a lot of emissions, and there's a little bit that we can do here, but we think, kind of in the proportion here, that additional reductions could be realized with further requirements on abandoned wells, for instance, and so see health benefits there as well. And with all of this, the transition of workers is really going to, I think, be important here. The natural gas system will likely be around for a couple of years, and so we need to ensure that that we have the right folks with the right education and skills working in those roles and understanding what it takes to shut down these facilities, to decommission various facilities, and understand the changing operations as the grid transitions. And so with that, I think that rounds up the slides that we have for this topic. If we could go back one slide, and I'll open it up to any other panel members that would like to make any points here.
This is more a question than a point, but have we done any analysis on the job creation opportunities? Because it's so interesting the way it's always framed. I mean, it's interesting the way it's always framed as like a job loss, but in reality, transitioning off of gas could be an even bigger job creator if done right, because it just seems like this is such an enormous undertaking, and that, you know, to properly detect and repair all of these leaks, you know, even as we're decommissioning, it's a tremendous effort. So I just wonder, like, is NYSERDA doing, you know, a study on that? And, you know, it'd be great to just better understand that. And also, I know we say here the local municipalities are key stakeholders, but in the last slide, there's a point about like regional and I think something regional and something coordination, but not local. Can you maybe go back one, Sarah? Coordination with regional and federal entities. It just seems like we also need to really highlight the role of local as well, local and county and regional, right? This is going to be, this is a big undertaking. And typically, and as we always say, you know, all politics is local. I mean, if there's like a methane leak on your block, who are you going to call? You know, your utility, you'll call maybe your town hall. So just, you know, making sure I think that our local municipalities are really a part of this process and working as effectively as possible with utilities, you know, and prioritizing safety above all, of course, but it just seems like that's a really key piece of that. So, and one I'd be interested in learning more about in addition to, you know, the jobs question.
So I do believe that this is that NYSERDA is looking into this and is coordinating with its the clean energy job study that it does on an annual basis. I don't know more than that though. I don't know if potentially Corinne or if anyone else on from NYSERDA has more information on that. If not here, we can certainly get back to you, though.
Savannah, this is Macy. We can certainly get back to you on that information. I don't have the specifics on hand right now, but it's something that we're definitely thinking about.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. And I also wanted to underscore the importance of this set of recommendations. I'm really glad we're digging into them. And there are a whole bunch of important interrelated issues here, of course. Nabeta highlighted many of them, but there are short-term impacts on health, on public safety that we need to address, and we need to think about the natural gas infrastructure as a whole. And the recommendation, which we know we is still under development, is super important in this regard. If we want to curb the role, you know, if we want to address the role of methane leakage, if we want to move away from gas in New York State, which the CLCPA requires, then we can't stop, you know, we can't continue to approve natural gas infrastructure in the way that it's been done in the past. And we need to kind of move away from gas infrastructure and not add to it. So what that looks like, what that recommendation looks like, is really important. We need to dig into it. But we can't, in addition to sort of stopping the leaks in the existing system, we have to stop expanding the existing system. And I just wanted to flag that.
Thank you, Kit. Lisa?
Thank you. Thank you, Kit. We were on the same page. I also wanted to make a proposal very similar to what we have in front of us, this idea of, you know, banning all new gas power plants, as a real important stopgap so that we're not creating a worse problem as we're trying to decrease emissions in the electric sector. I would like to also put on the table that we do have something in these recommendations of no new pipelines, no new fracked gas pipelines. There's another question that I actually wanted to ask, because I know that these slides and this conversation has, you know, we really haven't really dug into recommendations yet on this in full force, but you know, I would like to really make sure that there is feedback from the anti-fracking organizations in New York that are really doing a lot of important work around no new frack gas infrastructure. Because I think that, like, getting some recommendations from them, you know, in advance of, you know, the next steps discussion, I think is going to be super important, because they are leading such important work here in New York. And the question that I have is that this is really, maybe tell me if I've got this right or not. But it seems like this is really relegated to, when we say infrastructure, we're talking about pipelines and heating source, like the source side. But I wanted to, like, I just had a question of, you know, I do see some other, quote, leakage concerns just from, you know, the power generation angle. And this is this idea of leakage from the case that I think the gas industry is, like, really starting to make in New York, which is, you know, fracked gas has a future in New York, because, you know, there's going to be these, like, behind the meter usage for gas from power plants, like in the future. And there is this emerging issue with the Greenwich gas plant where, you know, that plant has an incredibly low capacity factor. But what's happening now is that there's going to be a data center and a Bitcoin mining operation. And that's actually going to increase emissions over time. And that is also a form of leakage. And so I think what it raises and something for us to really consider is, you know, what kinds of limitations are we going to be putting on site, emission limits and caps, so that we're really setting the groundwork and rooted in this idea that all this behind the meter stuff using fossil fuel infrastructure that we're trying to get out of the grid, but now we're creating all of these new uses for more, you know, fracked gas from, you know, existing power plants. I think it's creating another leakage problem that I just really want to kind of center in this discussion as well. And I would, you know, I think that there can be some really great recommendations, you know, like perhaps like new air permits would be triggered if there's like a 5% or 10% increase in emissions. We could put limits that there's no increases that could occur above 5% or 10% from, you know, the overall emissions from the on-site emissions over the last 5 years. We could put requirements that all behind meter generation comes from renewable energy sources. And, you know, just to give a quick example, you know, the owners of the Cayuga and Somerset coal plants, they really worked hard to figure out how they would, you know, use their sites, the coal sites, for, you know, new job creation. There's like solar projects that are being proposed, and they are not, there are two data centers on those, you know, that are being proposed on those sites, but they worked really hard to get those data centers to ensure that they're run on renewable energy rather than, you know, keeping those existing plants or trying to make a case to make those from, you know, from a coal plant to a gas plant. And so I just want to make sure that we've got our eyes on, you know, that like interim leakage in the short term, so that we're not, you know, saying, wow, here's all these great behind the meter ways that we can increase the use of our existing fracked gas plant infrastructure here in New York. So.
Thank you, Lisa. I see Amel's hand.
Yeah, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you.
Great. So I just wanted to make a point similar to the conversations that we've had on the generation side, that as we're having these very technical conversations and developing these recommendations, there are on the ground fights against repowerings. And essentially new power plants. And similarly, on the natural gas pipeline, there are current on-the-ground fights around that as well, in particular, as many folks know, around the North Brooklyn pipeline, which there is today a DEC public meeting about that. So just wanted to highlight that for everyone, and also note that in addition to the pipelines themselves, we should also consider the storage of natural gas and the vulnerability of those storage sites. In particular in the city, a lot of them are of course in our industrial waterfronts and are vulnerable to storm surge and are vulnerable to flooding. So there should also be some assessment of the climate risks of that infrastructure.
Thank you, Anel. Uh, I'm not seeing any additional hands raised by the panel members. I'll give it another 2 seconds here. Greta, I see your hand back.
Yeah, I mean, I put it in the chat, but just to go back to Lisa's point, and I know that we've had this raised a bunch by folks, which is the data center issue. And I just wonder, have we talked at all about, like, you know, mandating that certain facilities such as data centers, you know, have either like on-site renewables or procure their power from renewables? And going back, and I know that's not necessarily exactly what this particular slide pertains to, but just, you know, since Lisa raised the point, it would be great to hear if that's something that, you know, other people, you know, on the panel would want to add or talk more about, because I certainly think it's a great idea.
Thanks, Betta. I don't see any hands raised, but I did see a couple of head nods when you were saying that. Kit's indicating she agrees. Great. Okay. And so with that, it looks like without any additional hands here, perhaps we should move on to the next topic, which will be, I have it as slide 15. Here when we get to, as we've discussed, as a panel, getting to 70 by 30, the 70% renewables by 2030, and then the zero emission by 2040. One of the areas where we have, where we've kind of gone back and forth is, you know, making that step from the 70% to zero emission. Like, what is that remaining 30%? What is that made up of? And what should we rely on? This has been something that's kind of come up both in the panel and in some public comments. And so we have a couple of areas here in the next couple slides where we wanted to kind of address that. And so as we move towards the zero emissions grid, again, we're recognizing that flexible and dispatchable resources are going to be critical. But at this point in time, we need further analysis, technical development, and research in order to determine the feasibility, the climate impact, the health impacts of both advanced fuels and nuclear. Ideas that the panel has come up with in terms of draft recommendations is that during planning that emissions-free resources should be prioritized where feasible, and also considering all the kind of the important points of the end uses, technology limitations, and costs. But that if a substitute for natural gas is still needed, that advanced green hydrogen and possibly renewable natural gas could help to fill this gap in order to maintain reliability, assuming that scalability, feasibility, and environmental impact issues can be addressed. Putting forward here the additional analysis and research is needed in a few areas, including the life cycle carbon accounting. Not all advanced fuels are the same, and so really looking at prioritizing the lowest carbon emission feedstocks, and even if we can, zero emission or negative emission sources. Looking at the air quality and health impacts, as well as safety of these fuels and their operation,
and then technology innovation development and scaled deployment to ensure that we could rely on whatever technologies. So basically not putting our eggs in that basket until we have more information. I'll go on to the next slide because it's also related to this, and then we can come back. So slide 16. We have received a number of comments from folks in regarding nuclear. In terms of Indian Point specifically, which has come up in a number of public input sessions, the way the panel is looking at it is that there's a legal agreement that has been in place since 2017 that has the schedule for Indian Point to deactivate Unit 3 by April 30th of this year. And given the panel's charge, its jurisdiction, and the timeline, really are separating out Indian Point and not including it in kind of the considerations going forward in the resource mix. But we do have a variety of other nuclear facilities in the state, often referred to as the upstate nuclear facilities. We currently have a zero emissions credit program that provides financial support to the facilities, and that runs through 2029. And so as we see it, the nuclear facilities, the upstate nuclear facilities, are within the resource mix through 2030, and but beyond that, there's again a need for more evaluation to determine kind of the next actions and requirements. And so, a draft recommendation being put forward for discussion here is that analysis should occur prior to the end of the ZEC program in 2029 to determine how much, whether the remaining nuclear fleet should contribute to the 2040 mix. And looking at it from a standpoint of their ability to contribute to base load and meet reliability requirements, as well as the health, safety, and environmental concerns and licensing issues, and should public policy mechanisms be needed for the continuation of the nuclear generation facilities, that we definitely need to involve the public and have effective mechanisms for stakeholder input in that process. And so with that, I'd like to open it up for discussion to the panel members, whether either on this slide or the prior one. John Reese.
Thank you. I want to talk about order of magnitude when it comes to the introduction here. The independent evaluations of getting to 2040, the study, the PSC commission, NYSERDA work, NYISO work, they all identify a large gap to getting to zero carbon in 2040 with the existing technology. And so the other panel members are going to get tired of me saying this, I'm sure. I saw you smiling, Bennett. Between 15 and 25,000 megawatts of generation or supply have been identified as being needed in 2040 to ensure the lights stay on. In this study done at the PSC's request, it was identified as renewable natural gas, and that was identified as a proxy. We don't know what that is. What we do know is that currently, given current technologies as evaluated within the last 6 months, we need something else to keep the lights on in 2040. We don't want that to be natural gas. We don't want that to be oil. We don't want that to be fossil fuels. We want that to be a zero carbon resource. And by saying if we need it in 2040, I think misidentifies where we are today. I think, and I've been a strong advocate of this over the last 4 months of discussion, is we really need sort of a moon race kind of investment in finding what zero carbon technologies, whether they be a long duration energy storage product, whether they be a green hydrogen that can be green hydrogen, whatever that is, we need to aggressively pursue these options and a multitude of options, because odds are no one is going to work. It's going to take a number of results to get us there. And that if we don't, we're going to default into a carbon future that I don't think anybody in this panel wants. And so I don't want in any way to undermine this effort. And I think we need to put, you know, even more resources than we've talked about into getting to zero carbon alternatives, because it takes a decade to build a resource in New York. And that means by 2030, you need your 2040 solutions on the table and ready to go. We need to know what those array of solutions are. So that's the end of my tirade. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I think I saw Bill's hand and then Lisa's.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. So certainly I appreciate John's points around the magnitude of the challenge that we have here. I think this is one of the reasons why we have in other areas some of the recommendations that we have, such as the Long Duration Storage Center of Excellence to drive for really developing long duration storage in a meaningful scale to address these issues. I also appreciate that we're going to need lots of options on the table going forward. My point I wanted to make before I had John to make the statements here was around green hydrogen particularly. And I've said this in the subgroup, but I want to make sure it's clear here that we tend to, I think there's a lot of concerns around green hydrogen being combusted in peaker plants or being used in some ways that may not be as clean as it can be. It's very important that everybody understands that green hydrogen, i.e. hydrogen that's made from water, take electricity at low temperatures, split water apart and make hydrogen, and then take a fuel cell and put that water back together, is environmentally pristine. It is a very effective way to store energy for a long time, and it's also a very effective way in transportation for lots of different applications. So it's very important that we don't accidentally make recommendations that put all green hydrogen into the same bucket when we're thinking about this. So I would recommend on the on the previous slide, that when we say things like we need to study the carbon cycle efficiency accounting for green hydrogen, we're really focusing, I think, that statement on, in the event that we need to actually combust hydrogen, how would it look? You know, there is some chance that that may have to occur, to John's point. I personally believe that it likely will not, that we will be able to use green hydrogen and other things in a non-combustion way, and then we'll be able to use long-duration storage and other things that are very effective that will avoid those needs. But it's critical that we don't accidentally take green hydrogen off the table or detract from its development because we're concerned about an application, not the main application. We have a company in New York State, Plug Power, that employs about 1,000 people in the state, that's using hydrogen and fuel cells and advancing those very clean solutions that we're trying to do. So that's what I'd like to bring forward at this point. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Lisa?
Thank you. And I just, you know, this is really funny. Like, I feel like we're in our subgroup meeting and I'm going to say the same thing in response to that, you know, John says. So I just, you know, want to say that, you know, I do take a little bit of issue with this, you know, constant, we need 15,000 to 25,000 megawatts, you know, in the future. And, you know, just kind of this like panic fear mode mentality that we've got to just like throw all these bucks and, you know, at something now. I'm not saying that that is not maybe serious, you know, but what I feel like I'm a broken record in saying this is that we need to try, we need to actually lean in and get some policies in place over the next 5 years in terms of local transmission upgrades, how we're like really leaning into redesigning the grid, especially downstate, how we're using the resources that we have now, distributed energy, demand response, and energy efficiency solutions and storage. And I feel like once we get those policies and those processes in place, including a standalone storage docket that is going to take seriously the goal that we need 15 gigawatts of storage, because the same study, you know, that I think we're citing here also says that that is like a critical priority. So, you know, those things need, in my mind, if we're talking about policy, if we're talking about state resources and bucks, you know, those things need to get prioritized absolutely and essentially first from now until the next 5 years and moving forward and starting to build the scale. Maybe we can start like saying like, let's like put a ton of money, you know, in all of this. And we've got like, as Bill said, there is, you know, we already know some solutions that we really do want to put bucks into on long duration storage. There's creative ways that we can get there. We need some financing mechanisms. Can the Green Bank help us? Can, you know, where are we going to, you know, be able to get these investments that are needed so that we're setting up the, you know, what we need now, but not, I'm worried about this like reversal of prioritization where, you know, we're focused so incessantly on the last 5% that we're forgetting about how critical it is now and in the next 5 years. To build the policy, the frameworks, and scale the stuff we actually know. And this is including local transmission, because then we're going to know that number a little better and know through our success. There's one thing that I do want to talk about on this RNG and, you know, hydrogen issue. And I've said this several times, you know, I think it's getting really muddled, because right now the gas industry is basically saying, look, permit us now to build new gas power plants. And then, you know, in 2040, we'll stop burning this gas and we'll just go to this magic green hydrogen solution. And so I think it's getting co-opted, this idea of green hydrogen, because that the combustible part of that is not, I'm not convinced that that's actually green. It's definitely not emissions free when you look at the data, that's the early data coming out on NOx in particular and NOx emissions. We don't know the costs, the safety. And so, you know, it's just, I think that it's getting muffled because it's being used as a Trojan horse to get new gas permitted now, and then we'll figure this out later. So I do have a recommendation, I think, that might help us move to the next stage of this. And in our discussions on advanced emissions-free technology, and I really do think it would behoove us to really get a recommendation in place that the Department of Public Service and DEC, or, you know, I think it would probably maybe best come from the PSC, you know, initiate a rulemaking process where we are defining what is emissions free, because the CLCPA is, right, it's a zero emissions grid by 2040. So I just want to make sure it's not zero carbon, it's zero emission. And so I think it would be really good and behoove us to really get those parameters around what technologies are truly emissions free. And so that it gives DEC guidance, and then it gives, you know, guidance for the technologies that we are actually going to invest in, so that we can set ourselves up for what John is talking about, to really be prepared for the last percent, whatever that may be. So that's my spiel.
Thank you, Lisa. I saw Kit's hand up next.
Thank you. And this is also a really important discussion, of course. And I think the set of recommendations that we're converging on are moving in the right direction, because while I agree with John that there's certainly a risk in letting these decisions go until too late, in other words, deciding what the zero emissions 2040 resource mix is, there's also a risk associated with deciding it too early in terms of the environmental health impacts of some of these technologies, the questions around scalability of some of these technologies, and the costs. So I think we need a iterative process where we're not taking zero carbon solutions off the table necessarily, but we're also not wedding ourselves to them prematurely. And I do think we have a set of RD&D slides, which Sarah, maybe we've presented in the past. And I think those recommendations do a good job getting at some of the concepts that Bill was talking about. You know, what are the centers of excellence? What are the research bodies that we need to come up with the best set of zero emission energy resources by 2040? And I also think, you know, change often happens slowly and then all at once. And we've seen these really dramatic decreases in the cost of renewables, solar, wind, offshore wind, and we have seen, we know there's this huge potential for energy efficiency and demand response in New York. So the gap that we see today, that the consultants see today, that the state sees today, may not be as large in 2040, or may not even be there in 2040. And we can't count on that for sure. So I think we need to approach this in a thoughtful way, in an iterative way, hard to pronounce that, and just keep doing the research, asking the questions of these technologies, see which rise to the top, while also tracking the progress of the technologies that we already have. And if we do that in a smart way at the right time intervals, starting now, we should have a good answer on time for the 2040 requirement.
Thank you, Kit. I saw Anil's hand go up and then Emily.
Great, thank you. I think Lisa said a lot of what I was gonna say, so I'll definitely second a lot of her points there. I think, you know, a greater focus on really just catalyzing the process and being more intentional about renewables and energy storage. And of course, as Kit mentioned, specifically energy efficiency, which we've already seen some recent attempts to roll back with the Part R exemption on the LL97. I also wanted to note that in previous conversations, and I want to make sure that this is still what's happening here, you know, we've said multiple times that, you know, through 2030, our vision and our goal is to make sure that we're focusing on the technologies that we currently have available to us, and that for that additional 2040 gap, we'll be doing more research to understand, you know, how we can close that gap, if there really, as to Kit's point, if there really is that big of a gap. We've had many conversations around the potential negative impacts of green hydrogen, of RNG, and other false solutions. So I want to make sure that all of that is captured as well. Green hydrogen, just as an example, you know, there's still a lot of questions around what the NOx emissions are, what the land use implications are, what, you know, the water impacts would be, if any. So there's just a lot there to unpack. I also want to highlight that a few weeks ago now, the New York Renews Coalition released a report called False Solutions, highlighting our concerns around all of these different alternative fuels and technologies that seem to be getting in the way of a lot of the renewable energy projects. And as, you know, Lisa noted, there are, you know, power plants right now that are trying to say that they can switch over right away at 2040 to meet the CLCPA goals. And we can't, you know, let them use that Trojan horse to continue to operate, to continue to build a new fossil fuel power plant.
Thank you, Anel. Emily?
Thank you. I'm not sure I'm going to cover new ground here, but there's several points that I think we as a panel have been discussing for quite some time. I think that the idea that there are very challenging issues as we approach 2040 is something that should be formed as a motivator. I think that's the way it's intended. A clear view of the challenge we need to meet. It's not a threat coming from these studies on, you know, the goals of the CLCPA being something that can't be achieved. But part of the progress that we need to make is clear communication on how big some of those challenges are. So I think that one of the elements of our approach that we're all in agreement on is how critical it will be to refine our view through time. A lot of the studies that have been done so far are based on what is known today. What is the possibility of transmission being built out? What is the possibility of renewable build out? What is the possibility of the impact of electrification on the load profile? And as we proceed through time, we'll have more clarity on some of those elements and we can refine our view. And with that, we can refine how big that challenge is out in the 2040 timeframe. I wholeheartedly agree that there's a lot of good actions we can take today and productive actions, and that needs to be our focus. I think that where the panel is going as far as framing up that need in 2040 as really needing to be addressed through research and a commitment to continue to speak the truth is the right approach. And we can make progress on that. I also would like to frame up one other opportunity that we've talked about throughout these discussions is we need to think about the benefit of wholesale markets in additionally encouraging investment. One of the elements called out in these slides is how we deal with the concepts of ZECs and the nuclear fleet looking into the future. One approach that the NYISO has put forth is the idea of carbon pricing. I know that has different levels of support amongst this panel, but it's an example of thoughts that we can pursue on how to make the markets work to also solve some of these environmental objectives and needs. So I think that's an important element of our whole set of recommendations that's coming through the market's recommendation. So again, not sure there's anything new that I'm saying. I've heard these comments from my fellow panel members, but this is one of the toughest issues. I personally feel good as long as we continue to talk about it and acknowledge it. That's an indication that we're on the right track.
Thank you, Emily. Bill.
Thank you. I actually think we're we're getting some agreement on the and I think Emily and Kit recently phrased it quite well with the idea that we have a lot of work still to do, and that we should time that work to do the research and development of some of the things we know we're going to need, but leave the door open to doing more research and development as we continue to move forward and continue to evaluate where we are. To me, that's a very logical, sound approach, and I think we're getting a lot of comments around that. I also just wanted to just make a factual correction here on the green hydrogen comment a moment ago, which was really part of the reason why I made the comment in the first place, of the different types of green hydrogen, because the question about NOx with green hydrogen is solely a combustion of green hydrogen question. There is absolutely no NOx emission associated with electrolysis and then the use of the green hydrogen or fuel cell, zero. So we tend to sometimes worry about one application of something in a particular way, when all the other applications can be very, very good, and then talk about that application. So I share the concerns that Enel has and others have about possibly misusing green hydrogen. But that's a misuse. I mean, that's a little like saying that I'm worried about water because people can drown. Yes, you can misuse it, but it's not bad fundamentally. And so I think it's very, very important that we do keep the actual pathways for green hydrogen fuel cells very much in our plans. And we actually have facilities being built in New York right now to be able to do this, that will be very helpful to our future. With that said, just to kind of further the some of the other pieces here, there's still a lot to be learned in our studies as far as how much overbuilding of renewables we can do, how much more we can do with energy storage, how much more we can do with long duration energy storage, how much we can do with other things like green hydrogen and fuel cells. As we do this work, I think we're going to learn a lot over the next few years. To John Reese's point, we definitely have to do that quickly enough so that we can actually be building these things starting in 2030, which gets circled back to kind of this, some of these initiatives in the research and development. The key there is development. It's not just research. We need to actually demonstrate some of these pieces on the grid in large-scale demonstration projects over the next 10 years as well. But with that done, I think we can be on a very good track to do this.
Thank you, Bill. I'm picking up from this discussion, we need to be much more specific in what we're talking about in terms of the technology and what the use case is for it. Thank you. I'm not seeing any additional hands from panel members. Oh, Beta.
Oh, thanks. I agree with a lot of what's been said, and Lisa's point about the, I think this is what you said, Lisa, having like a, you know, standalone proceeding to determine what we really mean by emissions free sounds like a really important recommendation that I would hope everybody could get behind. And also, actually, can you just go back to is it the next slide, I think, about that focusing more on nuclear? Yeah. Not that far. One other thing I think that really needs to be highlighted here, we say, you know, consideration should be provided, blah, blah, about, you know, reliability, health, safety, environmental concerns, and licensing. One thing I don't believe we've talked much about is the cost. And I think it's something like $8 billion between like 2017 and 2029 is being spent to subsidize the nuclear industry and basically Exelon. And so it just seems like we should dig into that. And if we are making projections about whether we need nuclear going forward, like have some real analysis about, you know, if that money was spent to really, you know, drive renewables and address a lot of the costs that are involved with renewable developments, especially, you know, DER. I mean, developers are supposed to pay all of these like upgrading costs and interconnection. And so you see where I'm going with this. You know, how can we, like Lisa's saying, really, you know, ramp up, do this at scale, you know, as quickly as possible, you know, not wait for that. And especially when it comes to nuclear power, because it does, it seems like it's this issue that a lot of people have raised both for and against in the public at our public comment meetings. But I don't know if we've really, unless I missed a meeting, you know, dug in more to the costs associated with that program and what would it look like to shift costs to really invest more in renewables and especially DER, because we're, seems like we're spending a lot on the utility side, which is great, utility scale. But, you know, I was kind of joking before about why aren't we seeing like every, you know, big box store have solar panels? I mean, it's, there's a reason why, right? It's, so let's, you know, hopefully come up with some more concrete recommendations on that. And maybe to Bill's point about overbuilding, you know, another issue that maybe we haven't looked at enough. I know I saw a presentation a year or so ago by Richard Perez at the University of Albany, who does a lot of, you know, research and analysis on overbuilding solar. But maybe that's something the panelists would be interested in reviewing. You know, maybe there are other analysts who are looking at, you know, overbuilding and the role that could play with storage, of course, you know, and what the costs really are and being honest about the costs for all of this. And doing that analysis, you know, as soon as possible. So, yeah, just something that I wanted to make sure we really capture and wrestle with.
Thank you, Beta. Darren?
Well, Beta raised issues that we were going to be wrestling with the ZEC program, so I thought I'd just add on a little bit. I think good to bring up the cost issues. One of the other aspects is how sort of ZECs or sort of the nuclear facilities, the subsidized facilities play with a large, basically, renewable fleet. So one of the things you certainly see is that the ZEC program, the value of it, it does do is it provides consumers with savings in the wholesale market, which is a good thing. Unfortunately, simultaneously, it also makes the renewable program more expensive. So there is there is some interplay between the two, and it might be good as a group that we sort of take a look at both the costs and how those interplay work, where sort of basically those renewable assets are, where the nuclear assets are, and how they're sort of how they're playing together, and how at times actually we may be subsidizing sort of cross subsidizing resources and sort of sending both a little bit of mixed signals and potentially wasting resources for our consumers. So just thought I'd add that to the discussion if we're talking about ZECs a little bit more.
Thank you, Darren. I'm not seeing any other hands from panel members. I'll give it another few seconds and see if any pop up before moving forward. Okay, not seeing any. Let's move on to the next slide, which is next steps. Maybe one more forward now. So the next steps for the panel, we're going to have another public panel meeting on March 24th, starting at 9:30. Where we plan to discuss the remaining subset of draft recommendations. And we'll again solicit public input following that session. I also wanted to raise that the integration analysis assumptions that were mentioned, I think a few times, maybe a month or so ago, when we heard from E3 on their analysis, those assumptions are now available publicly at the link shown here, and we'll also get this out to the panel members in an email. There's a slide deck that walks through what the assumptions are for the integration analysis,
and panel members are asked to review that and get back to me with any feedback or questions. And if you can do that by March 31st, then I can compile it and get it back to the NYSERDA team that's working on that with E3. And then finally, the next Climate Action Council meeting is on April 12th. And that meeting will be reviewing the draft recommendations from about half of the panels and working groups underneath the Climate Action Council. And then, of course, there will be another Climate Action Council in May. I don't have the date off the top of my head right now, but that is the meeting at which the power generation recommendations will be presented. Are there any questions on the next steps? Kit, I see your hand.
Thank you, Sarah. And I will review the integration analysis assumptions, but I was wondering if you could just take us through very briefly that integration analysis process. I mean, I guess my understanding is that the integration analysis will bring together all of the different recommendations from the various different advisory groups and sort of roll them up in some way. But I was wondering if you could provide some detail on that process and how all these various recommendations will get to the Climate Action Council and in what form.
So, Kit, my understanding is consistent with yours, but I would have to rely on somebody from NYSERDA, I think, to get in a little bit deeper. I don't know if any of the folks on whether Corinne or Macy or perhaps Carl are able to speak up about that here. If not, we can certainly follow up afterwards.
Yeah, hey, Sarah, this is Carl Moss. I've been lurking in the background. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Thank you, Carl.
Hey, yeah. So if I heard the question correctly, it was about next steps with the integration process. So Kit, happy to share that with you. And I guess I'll point everyone to the CAC meeting number 7. I gave a short presentation on what the process is going to look like. So I can give you a quick summary now, but those slides lay out, and it's pretty short. They're about 5 slides, which kind of step through each of the points. But our objective, as you correctly said, is to have each of the panels put forward a series of detailed recommendations. And then what the state team will do is integrate those into an economy-wide energy and non-energy set of models to be able to bring those scenarios forward to the full Climate Action Council for their considerations. And so that will be a multi-month process. So that's what will be happening over the course of the summer. And that's a detailed techno-economic modeling framework, which E3 did present some early scenarios last summer, just to give everyone a sense of kind of what the methods and what the approach look like. So it's those same tools. That's the Resolve model that they presented to this panel several months ago. And it's their Pathways framework, but then integrates the Resolve electricity system modeling with all the other sectors. So they can begin to look at transportation electrification and the impacts on the grid, which we've had a great workshop around that. And so with that techno-economic model, again, there will be a family of different scenarios that will be applying the outcome of all the panel work to look at not only what are the greenhouse gas measures, so how do we reduce CO2, methane, N2O, SF6, HFCs, so all the greenhouse gases, but also look at the total resource costs across all those scenarios. So what are the net costs for the capital costs, the O&M costs, all the fuel savings, and do what can be termed a total resource cost assessment. And then layer on top of that, those carbon benefits. So the social costs of carbon, of avoiding CO2, of avoiding methane, and then layering further on top of that, health co-benefits. So we will separately, we have separate consultants who will be looking at the benefits of avoiding PM, both the primary and the secondary PM, and look at the local health benefits associated with burning less fuel in our communities. So it's that total cost benefit work, which is called for in the CLCPA, that will be developed over the coming months in a draft way and brought back to the council.
Thank you, Carl.
Yes, I was just going to say thank you.
Sure.
Okay, and with that, we've come to the end of the discussion portion of the meeting. And we were scheduled to switch over to the public input session at 3:30 and go from 3:30 to 4:30. I see we're a little bit early, but since we have folks on the line, I guess I'll put it out there. Should we just keep going and take all the commenters now? I see a couple nodding heads. Okay, let's do that then.
Sarah, is it okay if we have a quick break?
Yeah, break.
Yes, absolutely.
I think a break would be fabulous.
Yes, we'll take a 5-minute break. But we
will. How about 15?
Oh, excuse me, what?
How about 15?
15? Okay. Is that acceptable to other panel members?
Sounds good.
Sure.
Okay, so let's take a 15-minute break. We'll be back here at 22 after 3, by my count, and we'll start the public comment period then.
Thank you all.
Thank you.